Settlement to Superpower, Episode 13, A Voice Crying Out in the Wilderness. Hello everybody and welcome back. I'm Abraham Ash and this is from Settlement to Superpower. So last episode we discussed the DeSoto expedition of 1539 to 1543, the fifth attempt to colonize what is now the southern United States. The first attempt to do so was that of Ponce de Leon in 1521. The second and third were those of Francisco de Garay and Lucas Vazquez de Ayllon in 1524. The fourth was that of Panfilo de Narvaez in 1528. And now Hernando de Soto was the fifth. All of these attempts were clearly initiatives by a specific class of warrior adventurers, the same stock of conquistadors who had subdued all the rest of the Americas. The next attempt in Florida, however, would come from a very different, very surprising source. Because the next Spanish attempt in Florida, in the year 1549, was inspired and masterminded by none other than the protector of the Indians himself, Bartolomé de las Casas. How did this come about? How did this hater of the conquistadors come to advocate for an expedition to Florida? Well, the answer to that question lies in a long overdue discussion we need to have regarding the life of this remarkable man, and the struggle which he undertook for the sake of the American Indians. This episode, then, can be succinctly described as the life and works of Bartolomé de las Casas, and when we're done we'll have a far greater understanding of the background to the 1549 expedition, the status of the Indian in early Spanish America, and of course the man Las Casas himself. It's also worthwhile for us to examine the debate surrounding the status of the Indian which raged amongst the educated Spaniards of the time, as the Spanish books on the subject would come to have a profound influence on the English and their own later colonial policies regarding the Indian tribes around them. Let us then begin. Bartolomé de las Casas was born in Seville in 1484 to a prosperous merchant, Pedro de las Casas. The las Casas family was a distinguished one, one which reportedly traced its pedigree back to the founding of Seville. In fifth and son, went to the New World along with Nicolás de Ovando, the newly appointed governor of Hispaniola. Over the next 10 years, the youthful Bartolomé de las Casas participated in the Spanish military actions on the islands, was ordained as a priest, he was the first priest ordained in the New World, by the way, and became an encomendero himself. During this time, the plight of the Indians worsened dramatically under circumstances we will now relate. We've already mentioned some of this back in episode 3, but I would like to give the matter fuller attention here, now that we're giving the subject of Spanish perceptions of the Indians the respectable treatment it deserves. So European exploitation of the Indians began almost immediately following their initial encounter, with Columbus detaining several Indians he had encountered to serve him as guides, and indeed he sailed back to Spain with several Indian captives to show off to the Catholic monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella. Still, this was fairly benign in the way of exploitation, and we should point out again that Columbus was, throughout his career, essentially favorably disposed towards the Indians. He sought to convert them to Christianity, sure, but that was par for the course for any Christian, and Columbus never wished for that conversion to be violently imposed. Columbus also obviously wanted the Indians to assist the Spaniards in obtaining gold, but he initially conceived of the relationship as being more transactional between the Indians and colonists rather than exploitative. Of course, that plan didn't quite work out, but that was largely the result of the indiscipline and insubordination of the colonists who followed Columbus back to the New World. The monarchs as well wished that the natives not be molested, giving strict instructions to Columbus before his second voyage that the Indians were to be treated very well and lovingly. For Isabella, the fervent Catholic, this was driven by her conscientious desire to see the natives converted to Christianity, a process which she realized would only be stunted by hostile relations between the Spaniards and the Indians. For Ferdinand, who was less religious and more, shall we say, greedy, the driving motive was less conscience and more bottom-line profit. He realized that the depopulation of the Indies was an undesirable economic circumstance, and as such he, for the time being, gave his assent to Isabella's strictures that the Indians not be excessively molested. Columbus followed the monarch's instructions, mostly. He was still trying to keep peaceful relations with the Arawak Indians, although he recommended to the monarchs that they inaugurate a slave trading operation against the more warlike Carib Indians. Isabella refused, but even so, Columbus sent back to Spain 26 captured Indians to be sold as slaves. One must recall that slavery was a fairly accepted practice at the time among virtually all civilized people, whether Christian, Muslim, Hindu, or even Confucian, and Columbus, in pursuing the slave trade, was merely doing what the Spanish and Portuguese had already been doing for a half a century off the coast of Africa. But from these relatively innocuous beginnings, something much more insidious was beginning to develop. Back in Isabela, the colony founded and governed by the Columbus brothers, the colonists were developing a vicious contempt for the Indians, considering them to be stupid brutes, no better than animals of the field. These colonists cared nothing for Columbus's ideas of an orderly colony. All they wanted was to extort the Indians for whatever gold they possibly could. Under the leadership of the Columbuses, the colonists had, by February of 1495, captured 1,500 Indians, from whom they selected 500 to be shipped back to the slave markets of Europe, releasing the rest. It was said that the 1,000 freed Indians fled from the Spaniards with such terror that mothers abandoned their own infants in their desperation to get as far away from the Spaniards and their cruelty as was possible. The natives who were sent back to Spain fared even worse. Over 200 of them died wretchedly on the way back to Spain, and the remainder died very shortly after their arrival, their bodies being unused to the Spanish climate. Faced with this growing Spanish aggression, the natives soon revolted against these foreign invaders, and over the course of the next 2 years were so devastated by the colonists' military response that by 1496 the entire Hispaniola lay prostrate before the Spaniards, who were able to go wherever they pleased and do whatever they wanted to the Indians and their women. It was at this point, in 1496, that Columbus first established, in response to pressure from his turbulent colonists, the first form of the detestable encomienda system. Under this system, individual Spaniards were granted rights to certain tribes who would, with the cooperation of their chiefs, be compelled to work for the Spaniards, either in the fields or the mines, for a fixed period of time each year. However, the concessions Columbus made to his colonists, allowing for limited exploitation of the Indians, was not enough, and over the next several years, matters in Hispaniola got increasingly more chaotic. Finally, as we've mentioned in episode 9, the colonists revolted, and the monarch sent over a commissioner in 1500 who deposed and arrested all three of the Columbus brothers, and sent them back to Spain in chains. In 1502, the monarch sent Nicolas de Ovando to take the reins of the colony at Hispaniola. Along with Ovando came the man who would eventually devote his life to fighting Ovando's bloody legacy, the young Bartolomé de las Casas. So Ovando came and inaugurated a bloody regime of enslavement and exploitation. He formalized the encomienda system introduced by Columbus, distributing all of the Indians of the island to the colonists in encomienda, or in trust. The Indians were to be essentially the slaves of the encomenderos, or holders of the encomienda, under the terms of which they would labor for the colonists in exchange for protection and education in the Christian faith. This protection was of course a joke, and the Spanish very quickly resorted to brutal treatment of the Indians in order to extort as much as was possible, and the Indian population of the islands began to drop precipitously. Las Casas describes the behavior of the encomenderos, of which he was one at the time, towards the Indians. We quoted this passage already in episode 3, but I would like to do so again to set the stage for Las Casas' later campaign for the rights of the Indians. And I quote, "Thus they grew more conceited every day and fell into greater arrogance, presumption, and contempt towards these common people. They no longer felt like walking any distance. Having no mules or horses, they rode the backs of the Indians if they were in a hurry. If they had more leisure, they traveled as if by litter, stretched on a hammock carried at good speed and with relays. In this case, they also had Indians carry large leaves to shade them from the sun and others to fan them with goose wings. I saw many an escort follow them, loaded like a donkey with mining equipment and food, many of them with scars on their shoulders like working animals. Whenever they reached an Indian village, they consumed what to 50 Indians would represent abundance, and forced the chief to bring them whatever he had to the accompaniment of dances. Not only were they exceedingly vain in these matters, but they had other women as well who would serve in other capacities, such as chambermaid, cook, and similar offices. I once knew an organ maker with such maids. There were two kinds of servants. One, all the boys and girls taken from their parents on the Spaniards' plundering and killing expeditions, whom they kept in the house night and day. And two, seasonal workers for the mines and the fields, who returned to their own homes starving, exhausted, and debilitated. And it was a laughing matter to see the Spaniards' presumption, vanity, and air of authority when they had not even a linen shirt to their names, nor cape, coat, or trousers, but wore only a cotton shirt over another shirt from Castile if they had it. If not, they wore their cotton shirt over bare legs, and instead of boots, they had sandals and leggings. To console them for their services, they beat and insulted the Indians, scarcely calling them anything but dog. Would to God they treated them as such, because they would not have killed a dog in a million years, while they thought nothing of knifing the Indians by the tens and twenties and cutting slices off of them to test the sharpness of their blades. Two of these so-called Christians met two Indian boys one day, each carrying a parrot. They took the parrots and for fun beheaded the boys. Another one of these tyrants, angry at an Indian chief, hanged 12 of his vassals and 18 others all in one house. Another shot arrows into an Indian in public, announcing the reason for punishment as his failure to deliver a letter with the speed he required. Cases of this sort are infinite among our Christians. Having failed in their attempts to defend themselves, these gentle and patient people fled to the hills, but since experience had taught them the impossibility of escaping from Spaniards anywhere, they suffered and died in the mines and other labors in desperate silence, knowing not a soul in the world to whom they could turn for help. And this is the root of the doubt as to whether they were animals or human beings. Soulless, blind, and godless, these Spaniards killed without restraint and perversely abused the patience, natural simplicity, goodness, obedience, gentleness, and services of the Indians. They should have admired and pitied them and tempered their own cruelties, but instead they despised and belittled them, discrediting their humanity and believing them to be non-rational animals, and so it was thought throughout the world." End quote. It was surrounding this negation of the Indians' fundamental humanity that the first shots were fired in what would become the defining battle of Las Casas' life. The battle over whether the Indians were fully human and, pursuant to that, how they ought to be treated. In 1510, a group of 15 Dominican friars came to Hispaniola to preach to the colonists, under the leadership of Pedro de Cordoba, the first inquisitor in the New World. When they arrived, however, they were horrified by the oppression and exploitation of the Indians that they saw, made particularly galling by the fact that the Dominicans' old rivals, the Franciscans, were doing nothing about it. The Dominicans were stirred into action, and one of their number, Fray Antonio de Montesinos, was chosen by the group in 1511 to deliver a sermon which all the Dominicans had signed upon, in which they unequivocally condemned the encomienda system. The sermon, delivered before the principal men of the colony on December 21st, 1511, was a searing and passionate indictment of the entire rotten system of Indian servitude. Montesinos, who chose as his theme the verse, "I am a voice crying out in the wilderness," thundered before the astonished colonists. "I am a voice crying out in the wilderness. In order to make your sins against the Indians known to you, I have come up to this pulpit, I, who am a voice of Christ crying out in the wilderness of this island, and therefore it behooves you to listen, not with careless attention, but with all your heart and senses, so that you may hear it, for this is going to be the strangest voice that ever you heard, the harshest and hardest and most awful and most dangerous that ever you expected to hear. This voice says that you are all in mortal sin, that you live and die in it, for the cruelty and tyranny you use in dealing with these innocent people. Tell me, by what right or justice do you keep the Indians in such a cruel and horrible servitude? On what authority have you waged a detestable war against these people, who dwelt quietly and peacefully on their own land? Why do you keep them so oppressed and weary, not giving them enough to eat, not taking care of them in their illness? For with the excessive work you demand of them, they fall in and die, or rather you kill them with your desire to extract and acquire gold every day. And what care do you take that they should be instructed in religion? Are these not men? Have they not rational souls? Are you not bound to love them as you love yourself? How can you lie in such profound and lethargic slumber? Be sure that in your present state, you can no more be saved than the Moors or Turks who do not have and do not want the faith of Jesus Christ." Upon concluding his sermon, Antonio de Montesinos strode out of the church, leaving behind him an angry, muttering crowd. They had not enjoyed the friar's speech, to say the least. The colonists, Diego Colon among them, were downright furious with this insolent monk. They sent an angry message to the leader of the Dominicans on Hispaniola, Pedro de Cordoba, demanding that the order issue a retraction to their strongly worded and subversive speech. The following Sunday, Montesinos once again ascended the podium. Yet instead of apologizing and issuing a retraction of his earlier words, Montesinos doubled down on his message, hammering home that so long as they continued to behave in this deplorable manner, they had no hope of ever being saved, and Montesinos made it clear that from here on in the Dominicans would no longer hear the confession of any colonist who owned slaves, a class which included most of them, not excepting Las Casas. The outraged colonists sent a complaint back to Spain, which ended up reaching even the king himself, who was disturbed by the intemperate tone of the Dominicans and the dissensions it was causing in the colony. The Grand Inquisitor of Castile, the fanatical and harsh Franciscan, Cardinal Cisneros, also took the side of the colonists, ordering the Dominicans to cease and desist from their preaching on pain of being deported from Hispaniola. Finding their efforts stymied in Hispaniola, the friars would, within the next several years, successfully petition the king to be able to go elsewhere in the New World in order to convert the natives to Christianity. The Dominicans didn't entirely fail, however. Their complaints about the cruelty to which the Indians were subjected naturally concerned the king, as it was his royal interest which was harmed by the exploitation of his newly gained subjects. The king therefore had a commission formed for the express purpose of codifying into law the rights and duties of the native populations. Of course, there were quite a few more duties than rights, but even so, the ensuing laws were a positive development. Passed in 1512, the laws of Burgos ostensibly declared that the Indians were not to be overworked so as to give them more time for religious instruction, that they were to be paid a salary for their labor, and that the encomenderos were to provide them with all their needs. But of course, in reality, the laws were both unenforced and unenforceable from the distance of faraway Spain. Still, the laws of Burgos were a helpful precedent for those working for the rights of the Indians, and they would in time serve as the basis for more sweeping reforms. In addition, although this achievement was more farcical than substantive, The crown determined that in fact the Indians must be given a choice to accept Christianity and Spanish dominance before any war was to be waged against them. In this spirit, the Requerimiento was introduced. The Requerimiento was a lengthy speech which recounted the history of the world from Adam to the present, described the temporal authority of the Pope, and explained that the Pope had granted empire over these regions to the Spaniards in order to effect the conversion of their peoples to Christianity. The Requerimiento proceeded to demand that the Indians submit to this entirely justified demand on the Spaniards' part, or else be destroyed by Spanish military might. If the natives refused to acquiesce, the Spaniards would be justified in annihilating them. Of course, everyone recognized how ludicrous this whole business was, and the Requerimiento usually took the form of a hastily mumbled speech out of earshot of the Indians it was meant to address. Las Casas himself said famously, upon hearing of the Requerimiento, that he knew not whether to laugh or to cry. Now, when Montesinos posed the question to the colonists, "Are these not men?" he, whether knowingly or not, hit upon the crux of the argument. The European proponents of Indian servitude believed that by natural law, or the law which presents itself to man by way of reason independent of divine revelation, the Spaniards had a permanent casus belli, or just cause for war, against the natives. And bear with me as I explain the thinking at work here. You will probably be pretty repulsed by the ideas at play here, but I think it's important to understand what was then the fairly orthodox theoretical underpinnings for the Spanish program in America. Now, it requires a great deal of close reading to extract the precise formulations of the theory behind the program of Indian slavery, as its critics, most notably Las Casas, fairly consistently mischaracterized the nature of their opponents' arguments. I'm going to try my best to clearly convey the philosophical and theological questions at play here, but it is fairly important that you remember that there were many different formulations of the various arguments being bandied about, that it is impossible to make this summary a thorough digest of the philosophical debate. What this will be instead is a basic exposition on the two generalized positions within the ranks of European intellectuals, those who were in favor of the program of Indian enslavement and those who were opposed to it. So the basic arguments in favor of the enslavement of the Indians centered around two basic assumptions and accordingly assumed two basic forms. The first was that the Indians were essentially inferior to the Spaniards, and I use the word essentially here in the technical sense, meaning that these Europeans believed that the Indians were not merely uneducated and untrained, but that they were actually inferior to the Europeans in their capacity to learn. And being inferior in their inherent capacity to learn was a pretty big deal to the Europeans, as the only difference between man and beast, in other words, that which makes man and not beast, is man's intellectual capacity. Thus, the Indians were deemed deficient in that which the Europeans considered to be the essential definer of humanity, the intellect. On all European accounts, this defined the Indians as less than fully human. The only question was how far that subhumanity, and if we're going to be talking about this theory, we may as well express it in its full repulsiveness, how far that subhumanity actually extended. So, there were some who actually believed the Indians to be literally no more than a species of animal, something like the Nazi theory regarding the Jews. But that was not the majority position, or at least it wasn't the majority position after its religious and political flaws were pointed out. You see, such a position opened itself up to a devastating theological criticism. If the Indians were truly incapable of human thought, then they were also incapable of accepting the Christian faith. Christianity, after all, requires that a person accept upon himself belief in God, belief in the Trinity and the Incarnation, and so on. Any creature incapable of the comprehension of such beliefs cannot be possibly said to be a Christian. And indeed, the Dominicans complained back to Spain that there were those on Hispaniola in these early days who made precisely such a contention, that the Indians were utterly incapable of receiving the Christian faith. Indeed, we find precisely such a point made in 1517 by the treasurer of Puerto Rico, who wrote that the Indians of that island were incapable in all matters of faith. Now, to the pious Spaniards of the 16th century, this was in and of itself a serious point. Were they really willing to go so far as to deny the Christian religion to this entire population? But there was another, far more serious, political aspect to this point, that if the natives were truly a species of beast, then they could not be possibly Christianized. You see, when Pope Alexander gave the Spanish rights to the entire New World in his famous papal bull of 1493, he was quite clear that the entire purpose of this papal donation was in order for the Spanish crown to convert the natives to Christianity. In other words, the legitimacy of the Spanish rights to America and her wealth was entirely predicated on the Spanish effectively Christianizing the native population. If the natives could not be properly converted, then the Spanish rights to America no longer existed. This was an absolutely devastating critique of the extreme position that the Indians were truly animals, and as a result of it, that grotesque idea was blessedly short-lived. This view did resurge one more time in the 1520s when a few monks, frustrated at their inability to convert the natives, decided that in fact it wasn't their fault, and that the natives were simply animals, but by then such expressions were immediately met with vociferous opposition by nearly the entire clergy. So the idea was quite fortunately suppressed. Nonetheless, murmurings to the effect that the Indians were not entirely human would continue to be sounded until 1537, when Pope Paul III put a decisive end to the question with his papal bull Sublimus Deus, in which he asserted that the Indians were indeed fully human and could only be converted by peaceful means. But more on that later. I should add that while it may be tempting to paint the clergy, as Las Casas does, as disinterested humanitarians solely focused on alleviating the plight of the Indians, such a view is not entirely accurate. While indeed it would be in very poor faith to deny that such humanitarian motivations did exist among the clergy, it is also pretty clear that the clergy had a very large political incentive to combat this view of Indians as incapable of conversion to Christianity. After all, with the addition of so many unconverted heathens to the dominions of the Spanish crown, came a political power and perceived necessity of the clergy which had never before existed, and which was in fact never replicated again. The clergy was not about to let their newfound political power dissipate because a few greedy conquistadors found it convenient to label the Indians animals. But again, to be fair, it is quite clear that whatever their political motives may have been, there was still a great deal of idealism and humanitarianism on the part of the clergy. Anyways, back to those who denied the humanity of the Indians. The second direction in which this supposed deficiency of the Indians was taken was slightly less extreme than the view that the Indians were entirely animals, but it was pretty bad all the same. The intellectuals in favor of the enslavement of the Indians responded to the Dominicans that of course they didn't believe that the Indians were actually animals, but rather that they were people of such stunted capacity that they needed Spanish rule in order to civilize them and bring them to Christianity. This was the mainstream position of the Spanish intelligentsia, that the Indians were, on account of their severe mental disabilities, beholden to Spain for religious guidance and instruction, and that any war waged in order to provide them with such instruction was as such a just war, in accordance with the natural law. This rationalization was, of course, predicated on a certain expansive interpretation of just war, which maintained that offensive war for the propagation of the faith was in fact justified, something which would come to be disputed by Las Casas. And finally, you had a third way, which bore marked similarity with the second way, except that its focus was largely secular rather than religious. In other words, its proponents agreed that the Indians occupied some sort of subhuman spiritual category, but they argued that even independent of the Spanish obligation to Christianize the natives, they were still what Aristotle referred to as natural slaves, men who allowed their passions to govern their reason rather than the other way around. Aristotle believed that such men were naturally suited to slavery, and as such, it was in accordance with the natural order that they be enslaved by their better. And again, the doctrine of just war was called into play in order to defend the use of violence against these so-called natural slaves. After all, such a war was only an attempt to enforce the laws of nature, to ensure that order reigned over chaos. So this was more or less the intellectual defense of the institution of Indian slavery. I believe we have said enough so far about this abhorrent doctrine. The rest of this episode will document Las Casas' attempt to combat these pernicious ideas by way of both example and disputation. So, although the Dominicans on Hispaniola had been silenced for the time being by the powers that were, including the short-sighted head of their own order, their message was still echoing in the mind of one man in Hispaniola, Bartolomé de Las Casas. Las Casas, who had been shaken at Montesinos' sermons and the Dominican's subsequent refusal to hear his confession, did not yet fully come around to the Dominican's positions. As a matter of fact, he had argued with Montesinos over the substance of his sermon, but the seeds of a guilty conscience had already been planted in his mind. The moment of his conversion, so to speak, came in 1514, as he was pondering over a sermon he was to give, based on the following verses from the book of Ecclesiasticus, chapter 34. If you offer as a sacrifice an animal that you have obtained dishonestly, it is defective and unacceptable. The Most High gets no pleasure from sacrifices made by ungodly people. No amount of sacrifices can make up for their sins. Anyone who steals an animal from the poor to offer as a sacrifice is like someone who kills a boy before his father's eyes. Food means life itself to poor people, and taking it away from them is murder. It is murder to deprive someone of his living or to cheat an employee of his wages. In the middle of his reflections on these verses, Las Casas had an epiphany and realized that he and all the rest of the encomenderos were indeed sinning grievously with their conduct towards their Indians, and that all of Spain's actions in the New World thus far were illegal and unjust. Las Casas, profoundly moved by this moment of moral clarity, immediately released all of the Indians in his encomienda and began to preach to the rest of the colonists that they do the same. As you can well imagine, the colonists were not pleased to hear yet another meddling priest carrying on about how they were sinning against God by enslaving the Indians. And pretty soon Las Casas realized that if he hoped to actually change anything, he would need to go to Spain. Las Casas, funded by the Dominicans, returned to Spain together with Antonio de Montesinos, and commenced his lobbying for the amelioration of the Indians' plight. Las Casas was not well received back in Spain. Remember, most of the relevant men in positions of colonial authority were encomenderos themselves. Bishop Fonseca, our old friend, who as you'll recall was in a position of great authority regarding the American colonies, was in fact one of the single largest encomenderos in the entire New World. Such a man was not likely to take kindly to some nobody priest suggesting that what he saw as his rightful property was in fact illicit and ought to be revoked. Indeed, when Las Casas met with Fonseca and in the course of his case mentioned that 7,000 children had been murdered in Cuba over the course of 3 months, Fonseca icily replied, "And what has that got to do with me?" Las Casas got his chance to make his case in 1516, with the death of King Ferdinand. After Ferdinand died, Fonseca's power waned somewhat, and Las Casas was able to get the ear of the Grand Inquisitor, Cardinal Cisneros, who was currently the acting regent for the underage Charles V. Now, Cisneros was an awful man. I will definitely not deny that, and I don't think most of you will if you read about his career in the so-called Holy Inquisition. But he was also an austere man, disinterested in physical wealth. He was no Fonseca who would countenance the casual abuse of the Indians for mere profit. For conversion, yes, but not for profit. So Cisneros heard Las Casas out and he agreed to send a delegation of 3 Hieronymite friars to Hispaniola to regulate the encomienda system and to recommend what measures ought to be taken to reform it. Las Casas was also given an official salaried position called the Protector of the Indians, which essentially made him a special advisor with regards to Indian manners. The friars headed to Hispaniola at about the same time as Las Casas. For the next year, however, Las Casas watched in dismay as the friars did virtually nothing to help the Indians, on account of their fear of the colonists. The only thing the friars were willing to do was target the encomenderos who were living in Spain. And indeed, it must have made Las Casas' day when the friars revoked Fonseca's extensive encomienda. However, they were not willing to go any further than that. They concluded, on the basis of their interviews with the encomenderos, that the encomienda system was the only feasible system to convert and civilize the natives. Only the Dominicans kept up the fight, continuing to refuse to hear the confession of slaveholders and even going so far to say that any priest who heard their confession was himself living in mortal sin. By mid-1517, Las Casas had fallen out with the three friars whom he accused of complicity in the abduction of the natives, and was forced to return to Spain, shunned and reviled by virtually all of the Spaniards in the entire New World. Upon his return to Spain, Las Casas tried again to speak with Cisneros about the failure of the Hieronymites to do anything to alleviate the situation in the New World, but he found Cisneros ill and uninterested in anything he had to say. On November 8, 1517, Cisneros died, and with him died Las Casas' ally. He would now need to find a new high-placed patron. He found his new patron among Charles V's Flemish entourage, particularly Charles's chancellor, Jean de la Sauvage. The Flemish courtiers were impressed by Las Casas, and they spoke favorably of him to Charles V, who was, of course, then only King Carlos I of Spain. The young and idealistic Charles, influenced by his courtiers' favorable impression of Las Casas, entrusted him and Le Sauvage with revamping the economic structure of the Indies. Las Casas proposed a two-pronged strategy. The colonists were to instruct the Indians in agriculture and have them form their own farming communities which would pay tribute to the crown, while the ensuing shortfall in colonial labor would be filled by imported African slaves. You see, although Las Casas was a fervent advocate for Indian liberation, he was also an advocate in his earlier days for the enslavement of the Africans. He would eventually retract and repent this position, but this little detail of the protector of the Indians' views should serve as a reminder to us that we are still dealing with medieval men here, with wildly divergent worldviews from our own. In addition to the liberation of the Indians from the current encomienda system, the Las Casas plan also sought to replace the current short-sighted colonial policy with a more forward-looking one, wherein the colonial economy would not be based off of slave labor and gold prospecting, but rather by serious development of an agrarian society which would produce cash crops to be sold in Europe. Now, as Columbus had learned earlier to his chagrin, the Hidalgos could never be persuaded to actually do the sort of menial labor necessary for any serious agricultural enterprise, which meant that Las Casas would need to import some other source of labor. While African slavery was a partial solution, more labor was necessary. Las Casas therefore hit upon the idea of incentivizing and subsidizing Spanish peasants to move to the New World, where they would be able to develop the land in exchange for profit. The project, however, fell apart with Le Sauvage's untimely and unexpected death, which shifted the court influence over to Fonseca and those in favor of maintaining the status quo. Las Casas did manage to send out one small group of Spanish peasants to the New World, but they left poorly supplied and without any concrete plan. Las Casas was relying on the colonists of Hispaniola to assist the peasants upon their arrival, but predictably, no such support emerged. On the contrary, the colonists were openly hostile to the peasants who had arrived and did everything in their power to impede their progress. Predictably, the entire venture disintegrated soon enough amid the hardships and poverty which the peasantry endured. Las Casas, realizing that he could not rely on the cooperation of the colonial officials, decided upon striking out upon an independent course of action. He lobbied the king for a grant near Cumaná in northern Venezuela, which was a region more or less unconquered by the Spaniards. Las Casas hoped to establish there on his own a parallel society in which the natives would be drawn to Christianity by persuasion rather than by force. Las Casas' plan called for the establishment of a chain of 10 forts along the coastline which would keep the peace and protect the Indians, and which would each contain a team of friars who would work to effect the conversion of the region. Las Casas envisioned these monks as being of the same cut as the apostles of the early church, who would live among the Indians in poverty and simplicity and preach the Christian faith to them patiently and persistently. The Indians themselves would be gathered into townships where they would live, work, and pay taxes to the king. To finance the colony and to provide royal profits, Las Casas suggested that the colony and its investors be granted a monopoly on the local gold and pearl trades. Now, as can be expected, Las Casas' plan, which was heartily endorsed by Diego Colón, came under serious opposition from Bishop Fonseca and his cohort. They condemned the idea as unfeasible. They protested against the crown investing any money into such a harebrained scheme, and they even went so far as to slander Las Casas and accuse him before the crown of planning to abscond with the money hypothecated for the venture. Among Fonseca's allies was counted the newly appointed Bishop of Darien, Panama, Fray Juan de Quevedo. During the stormy debate surrounding Las Casas' idea, the bishop used Aristotle's theory of natural slavery to justify the continued enslavement of the Indians. Las Casas tore into him with language which must have shocked the educated observers of the debate. Not only had Las Casas said that the bishop was as far from understanding the philosopher's intention as heaven is from earth, but he also described Aristotle, who was the preeminent philosophical and scientific authority in medieval Europe, as a Gentile burning in hell, whose doctrine we need not follow except in so far as it conforms with our holy faith and with the practice of the Christian religion. In the end, in 1520, Las Casas managed to get royal approval and funding for his plan, although Fonseca and his faction managed to very significantly weaken Las Casas' royal backing. Most significantly, they managed to turn the king against granting Las Casas a monopoly on the local pearl trade, a restriction which very significantly impeded Las Casas' attempt to procure funding and investors for his endeavor. After all, if an enterprise doesn't look like it's going to prove profitable, then no matter how idealistic it may be, it's unlikely to garner much financial support. In the end, Las Casas got a limited amount of funding from the crown, borrowing the rest of the necessary capital from family members. Las Casas' grant encompassed the area around Cumaná, Venezuela. At the time, Cumaná and its environs had only two small monasteries, one Dominican and one Franciscan. Cumaná was also near the island of Cubagua, which served as a base for Spanish slave raids in the region. Bartolomé de Las Casas had, as part of his grant, received an assurance from Charles V that no conquistador or slave raider would be permitted anywhere near his grant. But as I'm sure you've realized, such an order was completely meaningless insofar as it was unenforceable in the wild frontier society of the New World. Las Casas and a small group of peasants set sail for Cumaná in November 1520. When they arrived in Puerto Rico in early 1521, however, they heard the catastrophic news. The Spanish slave raiders on the island of Cubagua had launched a series of slave raids in the area around Cumaná, seizing and carrying off the wife of the local chief along with 18 others. In revenge, the natives had risen up and sacked the Dominican monastery in the area, killing two monks, and that, in retribution for that, the Spaniards had embarked on a brutal punitive campaign right in the middle of the territory Las Casas had hoped to colonize peacefully. The news all but shattered any hopes for the success of Las Casas' endeavor, and virtually all of the peasants he had brought along deserted, fearful for their lives and despondent of success. After several months of fruitless negotiating with the Audiencia in Española for redress over the depredations carried out by the slave raiders in his area, Las Casas sailed for Cumaná virtually alone. Over the next several months, Las Casas attempted to salvage what he could of the situation. But all throughout, his efforts were hampered by the slave raiders of Cubagua, who kept on supplying the local Indians with alcohol. When Las Casas left the colony in 1522 to go complain once again to the Audiencia in Hispaniola, the local natives rose up and attacked the colony, killing four of Las Casas' men. The entire colony had to be abandoned with the total loss of all the capital, both personal and royal, which had been invested in the enterprise. The failure of his colony at Cumaná was a crushing blow to Las Casas, in not only a personal sense, as he was now up to his ears in debt, but also in a political and ideological sense. Las Casas lost a great deal of credibility and political capital in the fiasco, and at least for the time being, his lobbying was put to an end. To add insult to injury, his detractors seized upon the occasion as further evidence for their contention that the natives could not be converted through any means but the sword. Completely broken by the experience, Las Casas retired to the Dominican monastery on Hispaniola, joining in 1522 as a novice and taking his vows the next year in 1523. For the next 13 years, we hear virtually nothing of Las Casas, who presumably immersed himself in his studies and tried to forget what was going on outside the walls of the monastery. By 1531, however, we find Las Casas once again preaching to the angry colonists about the evil of their ways and the illegality of the encomienda system. In 1534, Las Casas tried to go and observe, presumably with a critical eye, the progression of Pizarro's conquest of the Inca Empire, but he was unable to make it beyond Panama as a result of inclement weather. Still, other than preaching, Las Casas didn't do much else for the next few years, again, presumably focusing on his studies and religious devotions. It is in 1536 that Las Casas once again bursts on the scene with all the passion and frenetic energy which characterizes this remarkable man's career. Over the decade and a half which had elapsed between his aborted attempt to colonize Cumaná and now, dramatic events had taken place, events which captured the world's attention, and which transformed the entire character of the Spanish occupation of the New World. These events were, of course, primarily focused around Cortés and his conquest of Mexico between the years 1519 and 1522. Cortés's conquests added millions of natives to the dominions of the crown, and, unlike the conquistadors who had preceded him, Cortés did not allow his victory to descend into a profligate and wasteful massacre of the Indians. Instead, Cortés initiated what became known as the Spiritual Conquest of Mexico, with the help of the Franciscan monks, who became his most ardent supporters. The spiritual conquest began in 1524, shortly after the physical conquest had ended, with the arrival of 12 Franciscan monks, most famous of whom was one Fray Toribio de Motolinia, in Mexico City. These weary monks had traveled barefoot from San Juan de Ulua, and upon their arrival, Cortés knelt and kissed their hands, giving them full authority to do as they deemed necessary for the conversion of the populace, and enjoining the impressed Mexican nobles to obey the monks. Over the next several years, the Franciscans undertook a massive campaign of conversion of the native population. They would shortly be joined by the Dominicans and others, but throughout the campaign it was the Franciscans who largely dominated the process. By their own accounts, the conversion campaign was a colossal success. After an initial phase of reluctance, the Indians reportedly came in swarms to accept the Christian faith. The reason, of course, why they came in swarms was that the form of conversion that the Franciscans engaged in was remarkably shallow. They would gather crowds of thousands of Indians for baptism, often without the Indians even grasping the most rudimentary elements of the Christian faith. The natives would simply be taught to parrot the syllables of the Latin Mass, without having the slightest clue of what they were saying. The Indians were barely catechized, and syncretism, or the fusion of Christianity to the previously held pagan religions, flourished. Oviedo writes mockingly of the priest who had kept precise records showing that he had converted precisely 52,558 Indians between September 1538 and March 1539. In the hope that the records would secure his appointment as a bishop from the Royal Council of the Indies. In addition to the superficiality of the spiritual conquest of Mexico, which can be simply described as foolishness on the part of the Franciscans, there was also a darker side to the spiritual conquest. The Franciscans very clearly acknowledged that without conquest, without the sword, without coercion, there was no way to convert the natives to Christianity. Indeed, the monks traipsing about the Mexican countryside would very frequently resort to violence, smashing pagan temples, flogging or imprisoning recalcitrant Indians, and even executing refractory Indian nobles. Indeed, the chief of Texcoco, one Don Carlos, was burnt at the stake by the Inquisition for resisting Christian evangelization, while in Yucatan, when the Franciscans uncovered a hotbed of syncretism, they responded with a brutal campaign of suppression, torturing and executing hundreds of Indian heretics. It was to this fevered atmosphere of proselytization that Las Casas arrived when he came to New Spain in 1536. Las Casas opposed the entire Franciscan program of proselytization with its focus on physical force, mass baptism, and a general preference of quantity over quality. Las Casas, who had been at loggerheads with the Franciscans ever since his life change of 1514, immediately set to work criticizing the Franciscan activities in New Spain, declaring their conversions to be invalid. He wrote a work entitled On the Only Way of Conversion, wherein he declared that it was only through persuasion, not force, that the Indians could be won over to Christianity. He savaged Cortes and Fray Motolinia, once again using strong fighting words, when he wrote of those who converted others by the sword, "These men are the precursors of Antichrist and imitators of Muhammad, being thus Christian only in name." Motolinia, who had himself bragged of converting 14,000 Indians in 2 days and who soon became the primary spokesman of the Franciscans, hit back at Las Casas, declaring him to be nothing but a big talker who never actually did anything to effect the conversion of the natives. Later, he continued prosecuting a sustained attack on Las Casas' reputation, denouncing him to Charles V as, in his words, "a man so vexatious, unquiet, importunate, argumentative, and litigious, who never failed to embroil himself in controversy wherever he went." Motolinia recalled to Charles an incident wherein Las Casas refused to convert an elderly Indian on the grounds of insufficient knowledge, despite the fact that the aged Indian had walked many miles to come to church. But despite Motolinia's best efforts, when the controversy between the Dominicans and Franciscans came before the Pope, Paul III, he handed Las Casas a major victory with his promulgation of the previously mentioned papal bull, Sublimus Deus, wherein he declared that the official position of the Church was that the Indians were fully rational beings who should be converted only through peaceable means. Las Casas, excited by the victory he had obtained in his fight against the Franciscans, decided to head down to Guatemala to try and truly convert the native population in keeping with his nonviolent principles. The governor of Guatemala reached an agreement with Las Casas, signing a contract with him that he would have full rights to convert the natives of a region in central Guatemala called Tuzutlan, or Land of War. The natives of Tuzutlan, a warlike people called the Quiche, and I'm probably mispronouncing that, had so far vigorously resisted any Spanish incursions into their land, so much so that the governor of Guatemala deemed them unconquerable for the time being. Being as he had no choice of actually conquering them, the governor figured that he may as well let Las Casas try to pacify the region. And Las Casas actually did a pretty good job of doing so. He basically gradually gained the favor of the local chiefs before gaining their permission to come in and preach to them. Eventually, Las Casas and his priests got a number of the principal chiefs to convert to Christianity and encourage their people to do the same, and he established a number of peaceful Christian Indian municipalities in the area. The area, once called the Land of War, was now renamed Verapaz, or True Peace, which remains the area's name until today. Las Casas' supporters have blown his accomplishments out of proportion, making as if he had actually converted the entire region, when in fact only a very limited number of Indians had converted. But even so, this should not make us ignore the very real accomplishments of Las Casas and Verapaz. Just to get a bit ahead of ourselves here, Las Casas' peaceful conversion of this warlike region very much impressed observers back in Spain, including Charles V. However, the story doesn't have a good ending. Although at around 1540, Charles declared that no conquistadors were allowed into Verapaz for 5 years, by the termination of that period, slave raiders were already despoiling the region of Verapaz. Pushed by the depredations of the slavers, the natives of Verapaz rose up against the Spaniards, reverted to their old paganism, and sacrificed one of the priests. Thus, the project of Verapaz ultimately failed, but even so, most observers in Spain realized that the failure of this effort could not be blamed on Las Casas, And in fact, he had been remarkably successful at what he was doing. But anyways, in the year 1540, Las Casas returned to Spain. He obtained, as we've just mentioned, the assurance from Charles V that Verapaz would be safe from any Spanish conquerors for a period of 5 years. He also, during this visit to Spain, struck another blow against his rivals in Mexico, the Franciscans in general and Fray Motolinía in particular, by getting the University of Salamanca to declare the Franciscan practice of mass baptism to be sacrilegious. He also lobbied successfully for the passage of a new series of imperial laws for the New World, which would come to be known as the New Laws of 1542. During this time, Las Casas also first compiled one of his most notorious works, A Brief Relation of the Destruction of the Indies, which shocked many in the imperial court into supporting reforms to the current system. The new laws were in many ways a restatement of the general principles of the laws of Burgos from 1512, with the difference being that the new laws contained a degree of confidence in the feasibility of imperial consolidation that the laws of Burgos couldn't even dream of. The principle that the Indians were the free subjects of the Crown of Spain, for example, was a principle mentioned in the laws of Burgos. However, nothing more than that was written into law. Under the new laws, however, the entire encomienda system was abolished, with all existing encomiendas reverting to the crown following the death of their current holder. The new laws, like the laws of Burgos, would not withstand the difficulties of overseas administration, but even so, it was an extremely important step towards the theoretical recognition of the rights of the Indians. Las Casas was also granted the bishopric of Chiapas, near the region of Verapaz, which he had just converted. Las Casas returned to the New World in 1545, where he formally took control of his diocese. The next 2 years, however, were tumultuous ones, during which time the local authorities refused to enforce the new laws, and multiple riots broke out against the person of Las Casas. On one occasion, the angry mob even fired shots at Las Casas. However, despite the antagonism it aroused among his colonists, Las Casas refused to bend, forbidding the priests under him to hear the confession of encomenderos even on their deathbeds. Finally, in 1546, following the official repeal of the new laws, Las Casas returned to Spain, once again a hated and reviled man among the ranks of the encomenderos. Upon his return to Spain, Las Casas found himself the target of furious attacks and recriminations, including the serious charge of treason. In Las Casas' recent writings, he had indicated the illegality of any war undertaken by Spain in the New World. This was borderline treason, and Las Casas' enemies back in Spain did not hesitate to jump on it. Las Casas was even denounced before the Inquisition as a heretic, although nothing actually came of that particular accusation. In 1548, the crown ordered all copies of the book in question to be burnt, an order which Las Casas' adversary in Mexico, Motolinía, fulfilled with great relish. However, despite all this, Las Casas was winning over many hearts to his ideas in the imperial court, and in 1550, Charles V took a step which is probably unparalleled in all history of any empire. As emperor, he ordered that all further conquests in the New World cease until the legality and morality thereof could be properly debated. Thus, the stage was set for Las Casas' famous debate, argued in the years 1550-1551 before a junta of 14 judges. Las Casas' opponent in the great debate was a highly renowned humanist scholar, Juan Gines, and I don't know if I'm pronouncing that name right, de Sepúlveda. Sepúlveda was considered a major authority on Aristotle, and he had crossed swords previously with Las Casas on the subject of war against the Indians. Sepúlveda believed that the Indians, both as heathens and as Aristotle's natural slaves, were just targets for Spanish conquest, and that until they were sufficiently Christianized, should be held in thraldom to the Spaniards. Throughout 1550 and 1551, the debate between Las Casas and Sepúlveda raged, although not in a face-to-face format. The two men would separately make their cases in front of the junta, tasked with deciding the debate, and rebut the points and proofs of their opponents. We're not going to get into the actual substance of their debate, as it would be way too tedious for us to actually go through each of the points discussed, But suffice it to say that the debate centered around whether offensive war was justified against the heathens, whether the natives were to be considered savage or civilized, and whether the ideas Las Casas was espousing about peaceable conversion was unnecessarily risking the lives of missionaries. The two debaters each managed to land several blows on the other, but ultimately the debate was decided to be inconclusive. Predictably, that meant that both sides declared victory, and as a result, the Spanish expansions in the New World did continue. However, it is pretty clear that at the very least in Charles V's eyes, Las Casas had come out ahead, as it was in the aftermath of the debate that Charles V finally gave Las Casas permission to publish his books, including his incendiary brief relation of the destruction of the Indies from 10 years earlier, as well as his subsequent books on the subject, including his magnum opus, the 3-volume History of the Indies, which he completed in 1561. It is quite clear that Las Casas would not have gotten royal approval to publish these books if he was not increasingly in royal favor following his debate. In any event, shortly thereafter, Las Casas resigned his diocese of Chiapas and spent the rest of his life, you know, polemicizing, fighting for the rights of the Indians, and in general, being a prominent voice with regards to Indian affairs. On July 18, 1566, Las Casas finally died in Madrid, having led a 50-year-long fight for the rights of the Indians. This is the context in which we're going to return to Florida. Next episode, we're going to discuss the attempt by one of Las Casas' protégés, Fray Luis Cáncer, who attempted to go to Florida and peaceably convert the natives. As we shall see next episode, the effort was to have tragic consequences.